This episode is brought to you by Burlap and Barrel, a public benefit corporation working directly with smallholder spice farmers around the world to source unique, beautiful spices for professional chefs and home cooks.
This week on Meat and Three, we're spotlighting the people who prepare our meat before it reaches our plates. We hear from whole animal butchers, the brains behind a meat vending machine, California cattle ranchers, and a master of charcuterie who isn't using meat at all.
It's like a smoked and grilled center stalk of the broccoli, and then it gets finished with some mustard, barbecue sauce, and sauerkraut.
Ranching and farming being as difficult as it is, you know, it's just one thing after another, and at some point you just give up.
I had a wild idea that if I learned butchery, maybe I could start to be kind of a link in the supply chain.
Listen to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
My name is Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Gentlemen.
Hey.
Another remote recorded Speakeasy episode. Some good news on my end and some bad news from the same outlet. You know, the Tales of the Cocktail Awards were finally announced virtually, the virtual Tales of the Cocktail this year. And the little bar that could, Amore Amargo, took its first ever Tales Award. We went World's Best Spirit Selection.
Now if we could just get
opened and be able to share some of that stuff with people, that'd be amazing. You know, let people come inside and actually see it instead of sitting at their tables out in the street. And then the bad news for us, but I'm trying to take a page from the Bolte playbook and bright side this stuff a little. Speakeasy Podcast was nominated for its third year in a row for Best Podcast Broadcaster Video Series, and we did not take it. But, you know, I don't even remember who took it 3 years ago, and we're on the list every year. So people see our name every year.
Yeah.
That's how we
win the award for being nominated literally every year that it has been an award.
Yeah.
No one else can say that.
I think we should keep the streak going and have them rename it the Susan Lucci Award. we'll take it in whatever it was. How many times was she nominated? 21 or some nonsense?
Something like that. And I hope that's not the case for us. You know, we're going to win it one of these days. There are only so many podcasts.
It's the Leonardo DiCaprio syndrome, man. Eventually, they got a cave.
Yeah, they're going to run out of other people to give it to.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, wait, you already have one? Okay, then Speakeasy gets it.
Take care. Hey, man, but you know what? It's really a testament of hospitality. You know, take care of everyone else first.
Yeah. That's
and right. then we take care of ourselves. So, yeah, you're welcome, everyone else who's won. We did that for you. We made it happen. Yeah,
we made it happen.
Be sure to tip us.
Consummate hosts.
Greg, I got to see your face the other day for the first time in months. You hopped on your bike and you rode over to Amore Amargo and had some drinks on the streets of New York City. Really happy to see you. How you been?
Yeah, it was great to see you too, man. I've been good. You and I were talking about this, that, like, you know, even though we do this every week and, you know, we talk and we're up to date on what's happening with each other's lives, it was super weird because we're sitting there and it's like, I think this is the first time that we've been face to face, or like it's happened maybe four times since Thanksgiving. Like, it was super weird.
Right. Which is, believe it or not, that's weirdly coming up. Like, Thanksgiving isn't far away.
Right. But yeah, I wanted to, you know, I wanted to come over because that's a big deal. You know, it's a well-deserved award. And, you know, you said while you were there, like, yeah, it was weird that, you know, you find out you have the award and you don't get to go up on stage and say anything. And I was kind of thinking to myself this morning, it's like, man, if only Souther had some sort of a platform. Perhaps even a weekly one that he could use to address the public with any words that he might have wanted to say.
I mean, I don't want to make it weird or anything, but I also feel a little bit hesitant about saying anything. I haven't really said anything on my own personal social media, but I have on Amore Amargo's, but only actually once. I still feel like it's, the climate is not one of celebration, you know, and I get it. It's a bright spot. It's a little bit of uplifting news in a very heavy time, but I feel like it's almost, I want to keep it private. Like, okay, they gave me that news and it helped me, but to like blast it out there seems kind of, I don't know, almost selfish during this time, you know. That's me in my normal playbook of the dark side. I'll try and come around and you know, get it out there so the masses can see it. But I was kind of overwhelmed with the flood of, you know, congratulations, text messages, DMs through all the platforms, et cetera. It was a little bit crazy, honestly. I don't normally work on Mondays, but I had picked up Monday for Mel, she jumped off to Jamaica because it's her birthday and she hasn't been anywhere since everything went to hell. So I was working when it happened. So just my phone just was exploding. And it was, you know, it's pretty gratifying, you know, to be recognized for such a prestigious award, you know, world's best anything is a big deal, you know? So I'm gonna get a neon sign made like the ones you see all up and down Broadway, world's best coffee. I'm gonna get one that says exactly that, world's best coffee.
Congratulations, you did it.
Yeah. Damon, how are things in California?
Oh man, well, I was just gonna say that, you know, I it's been 3 years that we've been nominated for this show for best broadcast, and we haven't won yet.
I'd like to point out that I've been on the show for 3 years.
Oh wow, is that it? Is that why we haven't won? Okay. No, I was going to say that I think it's very skewed. I mean, if we can't win 3 years in a row, and then you get best spirits selection, you don't even have a vodka, man. Like, how does that work?
I only have one bourbon. No, it doesn't work. I don't get it myself. I was very shocked that we got nominated.
No, man, you deserve it. Yeah, for sure.
100%.
Things out here in California are, it's cleared up. It's not, at least in San Francisco, it's cleared up. Smoke wise and everything. So it's a little bit of sunshine going on, and I just found out that no one told me. I don't read the news too much right now because it depresses me. Sure. So I just wait for people to tell me what's going on in the world. But I guess the travel ban has been lifted from California to New York.
Oh wow.
Whoa, rad.
All right.
That's what my business partner told me yesterday, and so I'll be swinging by some point soon to congratulate you in person. And
that is great news. And I, you know, just as I was happy to see Greg's face in person, I'd be just as happy to see you. It's been far too long. You know, I feel like, we hung out at least once a week for so long. And then now I haven't seen you. I don't even remember the last time I saw you.
I haven't been to New York this entire year.
Yeah. Insane.
Weird.
In all of 2020. It's crazy. I miss my bar. I miss you guys. Miss everyone. I miss the city. But things are just, you know, it's interesting to think of this too, just as far as kind of like a silver lining. I'm the silver lining guy around here, I guess. like I've been saying on this show and just around the industry that, you know, for months, over 6 months now, not just the bar industry, but, you know, the spirits and wine and beer industry, you know, like the on the sales side and distribution side too, and production side, you know, they're hurting as well because they don't have an outlet, or they don't have as many outlets as they did before, right? So I'd been saying a lot on the show that, you know, it's not really necessarily about, like, right now we're not talking about what we're going to put on our fall cocktail menu. It's more about just survival, right? But I'm happy to say that, you know, me and the team at Grand Army, we've been working on the fall menu. So that's been really fun. So there's these little bits of, positive little nuggets that are popping up here and there. So it's pretty nice. It's nice to, like, get back to workshopping cocktails for a menu, for a themed menu again. So it kind of restores a little bit more of what we thought of as normal. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely, man. Yeah, for sure.
Don't get me wrong. We've made a shit ton of spicy margaritas to go, you know, over the past 6 months, and that's great. But it's nice to get back and, you know, in the R&D mode.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're trying to start doing a little bit of that as well. Ravi's foolhardy and brave enough to be opening a new place during this stuff. So I'm working on some cocktails for that space. It does feel, you're right, comforting or like home centering, I guess is the word, to be able to get back to the work that we've kind of stepped away from for, you know, 7 months.
Oh man.
It's like, it's insane.
Yeah, totally. And you know, it's you kind of nailed the sentiment actually, because, you know, we've always done different themed menus seasonally for our cocktails at Grand Army, and this one's really based on comfort. I don't know if it's like guilty pleasures or if it's just straight up old folks, but it's like we're doing we've got a frozen drinks machine, and you know, we're doing a frozen pumpkin spice latte cocktail, and we're doing a Werther's Original Old Fashioned, and like just a bunch of stuff that's like guilty pleasure, like kind of like old and comforting. So yeah, I think that's what it's all about right now.
That's just the times, man.
Getting back
that's
to
what,
feeling.
It's what the people want.
Exactly.
Yeah, Greg, who we got hanging out with us today?
Well, today we have a very nice guest joining us. She is the founder of the Women's Cocktail Collective. She's worked all over the spirits industry, and she's now a spirits producer herself. She runs Pomp and Whimsy. Let me try that again. Pomp and Whimsy, which is a awesome gin liqueur. Please welcome Dr. Nicola Nice. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Of welcome. Course. So yeah, what have you been up to during this whole, we were kind of just spitballing about, you know, this is the time for, you know, people want creature comforts. People want to, you know, grab at those little fireflies of normalcy that are out there. What have you been up to during this whole crazy, crappy time?
Oh, wow. Well, that's a big question.
In 10 seconds or less.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think all of us, you know, obviously just sort of listening to the conversation and, you know, as you say, being part of the industry, I don't think any of us this year have been dealt the cards that we wanted, right? But I think that the other thing is that, you know, if you don't keep playing your hand, then you can't stay in the game, right? So, ooh. You know, it's been a combination of us of just pivoting and, you know, hustling and trying to turn the business around and make new opportunities. That's on the business side. And on the personal side, yeah, I'm not going to lie, I learned to make a pretty damn good sourdough in the last few months. I totally jumped on that bandwagon. And now my kids are so spoiled that they will not eat any other kind of bread. So I kind of set myself up for future failure, I think, as a
Yeah, you build your own monsters, right?
Right, exactly.
I'm just curious, why is it that specifically the making of sourdough bread became the big thing? You know, why didn't people go like, yeah, I learned how to break down and rebuild a carburetor?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with, I think
the process,
that,
right?
Yeah, the process. I think that it is comforting. I think that it is something you feel that you can have control over. It's something that takes some time to do. And it's not usually something that you would normally have time to do. So I think in trying to sort of find some of the silver linings in this whole period, I think a lot of people have been looking internally and going back to basics.
See, there's been two different camps this whole time as far as breads go. There's the banana bread camp and there's the sourdough bread.
Oh, I've done both.
And yeah, well, I ruined my sourdough starter. You know, and it's really telling of the fact that I am a bartender and not a distiller. You know, like I take the products that are there and fresh and like ready to go and make it, and it's instantly gratifying and delicious. If it takes a lot longer than that, you know, I'm going to run it and I'll lose focus. And that's exactly what happened. So kudos to you.
I think the other thing in terms of sort of needs must was the fact that there was a yeast shortage.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, if you were making bread in a bread machine or any other way before, that was no longer possible. So we had to look to our environment to create the yeast. But it's funny because after making sourdough, I then went on to start making vinegar because I'm like, oh, I've got all of the cool yeast in the air that's growing naturally and some leftover wine. And let's see if we can make a good vinegar too. So
what is this leftover wine?
Yeah.
I've never heard
what
of it.
What language are you speaking?
Is that a brand? Is that a brand I've never heard of? So, Dr. Nice,
yes.
you run a research firm called Think Conservatory. Talk to us about what you do at Think and what Think. It's all in capitals in my notes, so I assume that's an acronym. What's that mean?
Yes. So I'm a sociologist by training. So I've really spent the last 20 years in the field of consumer insights and brand strategy. And really what I am is an obsessive when it comes to observing human behavior. So I love to observe human behavior and behavioral norms on a micro level, right? So this sort of informs and influences how we interact with products. And I, at the same time, I love to observe cultural and societal norms, which influences how we engage and interact with brands. So putting those two obsessions together for the last 13 years into agency form, I've made my living basically going around the country and going around the world working with Fortune 500 companies to help them better understand their audiences, position their brands more effectively, and innovate and create new brands. And so that's really what I do at Think Conservatory. And about 50% of my work has always been in the spirits industry. So from the spirits and cocktail point of view, I am a student of the anthropology of the cocktail.
I mean, I think that's fascinating. Everything you just said is fascinating. I think in a small way, maybe Damon and Greg will agree or disagree with me right now. I think that's part of why or part of what drives me to be behind the bar. I'm always observing the human condition. I'm always, you know, watching how people interact with my space, with the products that I'm serving them, with the people around them, with me. This sparks a lot of interest in me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out leftover wine.
We'll come back to that. Yeah.
In doing all this, you discovered that a lot of spirit producers, especially, systematically ignore or misrepresent their female audiences. Mm-hmm. And that's what's kind of spurred you into the next stage of your career, right?
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, when I wasn't doing spirits consulting work, I was spending a lot of time in what I would describe as fairly female-driven industries. So fashion, beauty, personal care. And one of the things that always struck me as I would kind of pivot between these two different spaces was, you know, working in the area of personal care, I worked on the launch of Dove for Men in the US, for example. And he was a brand that was bending over backwards to show men who arguably are, let's just say, not as engaged in personal care and beauty as women. I think we can all say that safely. And yet here was an industry that was bending over backwards to tell men, you know, you of course have your own needs. Of course, your skin is different. Of course,
we need to take a shower
once a week, at least every other day.
That's my rule.
Of course, we don't expect you to just use your wife's products. We don't expect you to use Estee Lauder. You deserve your own brands and you deserve your own experiences and you deserve to be spoken to in an authentic and relatable way. And then I would sort of pivot over to spirits and I'd be like, wait, this is a category that women are really engaged with, right? So we know that 70% of household spending on alcohol is driven by women. And we know that one in three female drinkers actually prefers spirits and cocktails over wine or beer. And that's compared to one in four male drinkers.
What?
And so clearly it is a category that women are really engaged in. And yet when you look at the brand and marketing landscape of spirits, we are completely underrepresented, and where we are represented sort of talked down to in a very one-dimensional way. So making spirits about, you know, being about diet or being about sexiness or pink and sparkliness or whatever you want to call it. And this to me, as a woman, this was something that bothered me naturally. As a researcher, it was something that intrigued me. You know, it's like, oh, is there some kind of unwritten law I don't know about here that you can't market spirits to women, you know? And whenever I hear a norm like that, I always want to know, where does this come from? And, you know, can we break it down? And then as an entrepreneur, I was like, seems to me that there's crap ton of money being left on the table from not taking women seriously here.
There you go. The business side. That's what gets me too. I want to know how everybody interacts with everything so that I can make it so that they'll feel happy to leave me their money. And recommend that their friends come and do the same.
Yeah.
That's the goal. That's fascinating stuff. Listen, we should take a break real fast and hear from our sponsors. We're going to come back and keep talking to Dr. Nice about, well, we're going to talk about some gin when we come back. So stay tuned, everybody.
I'm Ethan Frisch, co-host of Why Food and co-founder of Burlap and Barrel, a public benefit corporation working directly with smallholder spice farmers around the world to source unique, beautiful spices for professional chefs and home cooks. We set our partner farmers up to export their own crops for the first time, and they get access to a whole new market here in the US, and we get access to spices that other companies can't source. We're honored to work with restaurants including 11 Madison Park, Blue Hill, and Chez Panisse, as well as thousands of home cooks across the country. Visit us at burlapandbarrel.com.
And we are back. You were listening to The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. We're talking with Dr. Nicola Nice, and we were talking about how a lot of brands are leaving money on the table when they kind of eschew 51% of the global market. You know, a lot of spirits are traditionally, you know, like just default to men. And it was just, and you were remarking before the break that it was weird that there are some brands that just, you know, will put out, will either not put out products for, like, you know, that are designed to be for women, or they will, and it'll just be this kind of weird sort of half-assed thing. And we were talking a little bit during the break about a particular thing that happened to you, Damon, when you were traveling and you found a very peculiar gin in Italy.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I was in Florence a couple of years ago, I guess, and I was at one of my favorite spirit shops in the world called Enoteca Alessi. My friend Antonella owns it. Her family's owned it forever. Anyway, we were, you know, I was going around the shop, finding all this cool, like, Amari and vermouth and things that we can't get back here, and I was in the gin section because I was with Brooklyn Gin at the time, and that's why I was there, and I saw this bottle of gin that was a pink gin, and I was like, this is cool. It's one of the largest gin companies out there. And I was like, pink gin, this is awesome. Like, I can't believe they started bottling this. This is right at the time where people were starting to, like, bottle, like, Negronis and other classic cocktails. And so I see this pink gin. I'm like, oh, cool. I got to get this because we can't get this in the States. And she was like, no, you don't want that. I'm like, why don't I want it? And she's like, well, that's for girls. And I'm like, you're a woman, like, what are you saying? And she's like, that's not the pink gin you're thinking of. You know, me being a cocktail nerd, I'm thinking, oh, it's gin with a bunch of bitters in it, but it was just a bunch of fruit flavored and labeled as a pink gin. It was actually called pink gin. That's what was very confusing about it, as far as, like, the, you know, as far as thinking of this very classic gin company that's been around forever and for the classic cocktail, albeit very obscure. Yeah, it was just kind of weird. That was, you know, even she was like, no, this is not for you. This is not marketed
right
towards you.
Right. And that's exactly what Nicola was saying, right? Like, this is an obvious missed opportunity. Talk a little bit about that, Nicola.
Yeah. I mean, I think that when you look at some of the examples of where the spirits industry has attempted to talk to women, and there are some very recent examples that, you know, I'm sure we can all think of and name, even though we can probably only count them on one hand. But still, I think when you look at those examples, the one thing that they have in common is that they tend to talk to women because we're women, not as women, right? So because you're a woman, you like pink. Because you're a woman, you want low ABV and low calorie. Because you're a woman, you drink spa drinks. Because you're a woman, you feel that you can't go into the, you know, the boys only club of whiskey, so you have to have your own name in order for you to feel comfortable. Instead of talking to us as women and understanding how we drink and when we drink and why we drink and how we want to feel and how we are the natural entertainers and you know, chief mixologists of the home most of the time, and speaking to those occasions and needs instead of reducing us to one single denominator.
Well, right. Well, even the statistic that you said about how many women versus men prefer spirits and cocktails over beer and wine, that shocked me. I was plainly shocked to hear that. What was it again?
One in three women prefer spirits and cocktails over wine and beer.
versus 1 in 4 men, right?
That's right.
that just bowls me over, frankly.
Right, because you're used to the societal norm that says that women like wine and men like beer. And
I've been programmed.
Men do like it, but like let's actually look at the data, right? Because the data tells you something different.
Right, and oftentimes you get a surprise. Like I feel very surprised by that. Well, let's talk about stuff you're doing now. And speaking of spirits and speaking of women, you're making a spirit and you're a woman. So Pomp and Whimsy.
That qualifies me.
Yeah. You're auto qualification. Talk about Pomp and Whimsy. I know a little bit about it. I've seen a couple of bottles about, but I don't know enough. So fill me in.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think that it's a nice segue from the pink gin because, you know, if you go back in time, back, you know, let's just say around 150 years in the history of gin, we all know that there were very many styles of gin around at the time. And we also know that the way people drank gin was different from how we drink it now, right? So we generally understand that people were adding sugar and bitters to their gin. They often drinking it in the morning, there was a belief that the gastrointestinal benefits of the juniper and of the bitters would help with the rich diet that Victorians had every day. And that they had a sweet tooth, and that when they weren't mixing their own old fashions, if you like, they were buying what we might now call ready prepared or ready to drink gin cordials from retailers. And these were, every retailer would have their own blend, and these were gins that had been cut in proof and they'd been infused and flavored and sweetened of varying qualities and styles. And what we know about these cordials is that they were extremely popular with women. So women were serving them at their social gatherings, their afternoon tea parties, their ladies' luncheons, what we could call the precursor to the cocktail party. They were also creating their own beverage recipes. They were writing those down. They were passing them on from mother to daughter. And as we know, back in the day, the nickname for gin was Mother Gin. So I kind of felt like there is a history in the spirit with women that we need to honor and we need to pay tribute to. But at the same time, I set out to recreate for a modern palate what the modern gin cordial might look like and taste like. So that was really the inspiration behind starting Pomp and Whimsy. And it has this, we have this dual mission, and one is to, you know, bring back the gin cordial style of gin and update it and integrate it into modern mixology and cocktails as we drink them today. But in so doing, pay tribute to the role that women have played in the history of the spirit and try to write them back into that story.
I mean, yeah, that's something that I've actually been doing a little bit of research on for an upcoming episode of Bar None that is going to be part of our third season. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I was inspired to work on this episode because of something that I interviewed a husband and wife distilling team many years ago for the first season of our show. And the wife was joking that, you know, back when distilling was considered, you know, uncool manual labor, it was mostly women that were doing it in the United States. But right. As soon as it became like cool and fashionable and artisanal, all of a sudden it swings the other way and it very much becomes like, you know, a man's world. I'm thinking of that. I think it was like Wild Turkey or something like that, that ad with like Matthew McConaughey and like a leather jacket you could practically smell through the TV walking down a street at like 4 a.m. with a bottle of whiskey. And like, you know who that product is for,
right,
by looking at that. Yeah. So, you know, it's, I want to hear you talk a little bit more, because one of the missions that you're sort of working on is writing women back into cocktail history, when they've sort of been pushed to the side after this became, again, major air quotes here, cool. So right. can you give us any sort of like a particular favorite story or a particular example of someone you found that you have sort of tried to bring back into the limelight?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm obsessed with this subject. And, you know, if I wasn't running a startup, I would be writing a book on my iPhone or elsewhere if I could. And I think that there are several.
Not recommended.
several books here that need to be written. But, you know, as I said, I consider myself to be a student of the cocktail, not an expert in it, right? But as I have researched more and more into the history of the cocktail, and again, it's sort of starting from this this dissonance, right, between this idea of women are not, you know, there's a norm that says that women don't really drink spirits and cocktails and don't distill, as you just said. And yet there's a reality, which is that we do. And I, you know, you go to any party in the home where there is some sort of signature cocktail, 9 times out of 10, it's going to have been created by the hostess of the event. And so, you know, I was like, well, this must have come from somewhere. And, you know, if I started to sort of read and study about, you know, the history of the cocktail as it's been written right now. And every time I would turn the pages of these books and I'd be like, where are the women in this story? Right. So, you know, I get that going back into, you know, the mid 19th century and the way that Victorians lived and the way that they considered the relationships between the sexes, you know, that men occupied public life, right? And public life was what was documented. And cocktails in public were being drunk and consumed in bars where women were not allowed. So you go back and you sort of, you know, you read about, you know, obviously everything from Jerry Thomas onwards. And it's kind of been this sort of legacy of bartending that's been passed down through male generations. And yet you always have to ask yourself the question, well, where did he get his recipes, right? And who might have influenced him, and what might have he been drinking at home? And, you know, what I discovered was that in terms of levels of influence, right, in terms of people who were writing about, let's just call them mixed alcoholic beverages for the sake of argument, right, but about serving mixed alcoholic beverages, who had the most influence? This became a question to me, right? Was it him? Like, I think we can all say that his legacy has been incredibly influential, but at the time, who would have had the most influence in terms of, you know, the number of books that were being published and who was reading them? And what you discover is that if you think outside the box a little bit and you think outside the bar, and instead of thinking about, you know, what were the books that were influencing bartenders and what was happening in the professional world, what was happening in the private world, which was not as well documented. But actually, there is a huge body of literature written by women, primarily around housekeeping, cookery, etiquette, household management, and entertaining, and so on. And in these books, you will find many drink recipes. You will also find recipes for distilled spirits. You'll find recipes for liqueurs. And you see that the way that women are thinking about liquor in the home is broader, right? So take a liqueur, for example, or a cordial. They serve three purposes in the home. So first of all, they were a way to preserve seasonal ingredients, right? So, you know, this is pre-refrigeration, of course. You have to be able to make use of what's in season and make it last. Secondly, they were used as household medicines and health tonics. So, for example, you'll see reference in these books to, I think it was Eliza Acton, who had a recipe for a blackberry cordial. And she notes that not only does this taste good, but it's actually a pretty good remedy for diarrhea, right? So this is the way women are kind of thinking about
it. Way to sell it.
Delicious and practical.
And then, of course, there is the entertaining element of it too. So just to kind of put this into numbers, since this was, you know, I think this is kind of where we were coming from here. Jerry Thomas sold 8,000 copies of his book in the first edition. Isabella Beaton, who was probably the most successful and prolific household management writer, she was a British writer, but her books were sold internationally. She sold over 2 million copies in the same time period, right? So the only book that outsold Isabella Beaton was the Bible. So this is Kardashian level of influence, right? When you think about, you know, who's reading this and who's being inspired by it and who's using the recipes and replicating them. So this was just, you know, this was something that, like, to me, I feel like we need to give women more credit for the impact that they've had.
But I think even what you just outlined for us describes that there's a distinct possibility that say Jerry Thomas or Dave Embry or some of these guys who wrote some books, they were getting maybe their ideas from being in homes at cocktail parties, then translating those into their business, of course, then transcribing that into books that weren't selling nearly as much, because who would be buying these except for maybe other bartenders, right? Yes.
Yeah.
That's fascinating to me. So, you know, for all intents and purposes, maybe Jerry Thomas was completely influenced by that book that sold 2 million copies.
Right.
Or that style of book, or that style of, you know, broader thinking, as you said, like, you know, the homemaker was thinking about the glassware and the presentation, mm-hmm. and possibly garnishing and like all those things, where, you know, at the bar, maybe we were just thinking in the earlier days, just get it in the glass and slide it across the bar.
Yeah. It's just a collaboration, like a collection of recipes. I mean, when you look at like Charles H. Baker's books, they're successful. You like reading them because they're entertaining. It's about more than what's just in the glass, you know?
Right.
And I think that, you know, with any cocktail book, that's just part of a much larger run of show of hosting people. And yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And if you sort of look at like the, you know, the anthropology of the cocktail in the home, you know, things like glassware, things like the punch bowl, things like, you know, ceramics and so on, serveware, this was all passed on to the daughter of the house. It was something that was given on the wedding day to the wife. Right. So, you know, it's very powerful that women were the ones filling the bowl.
I love this.
This is fascinating.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it just makes me think of like, actually, like going back to like your, as far as like being a host and like sharing not only these drinks and food and entertainment and all this stuff, like all the stories and like kind of like cultural goings on of the time. I mean, like even looking at your website, I mean, I kind of want to like talk about this for a second. Like you have on here what's called the Kindred Spirit Society, and it's Cocktail Stories and Other Lovelies is what it says. And it's kind of like, it kind of mirrors or echoes what you were just talking about as far as like taking that element of being a host and entertaining and communicating and generally, you know, sharing moments together and putting it in here on the website. So there's all these great stories about cocktails and about women in the industry, but not only in the industry, there's all this great history. There's also, well, there's a signature cocktail for Kamala Harris, and then there's, who was Pearl Mesta. There's like some really cool stuff on this website. And Souther, I don't know if you have your inbox handy, but I just sent you on the website, there's a cocktail gram section, and you can send people cocktail recipes
based on a
little questionnaire.
Yeah.
I sent you a cocktail just now. Sorry, Greg, I didn't want to type too much. I'll get you after the show. I didn't want to be typing a bunch and having it come through. This is great. I mean, you can tell that like you've done a lot of marketing research because you've put together a really cool package that's bigger than just the package, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is. It is a gorgeous website. So I know we're approaching the end here. I want to talk about two things as quickly as we can. We talked about Pomp and Whimsy, you know, kind of how you came to it. Let's talk about what it tastes like and how you serve and drink it. And then I definitely don't want to leave here without talking about the Women's Cocktail Collective as well. So let's talk about the juice.
Yeah, absolutely. So the best way, just from a profile point of view, to describe Pomp and Whimsy to someone who's never had it is as if Hendrix and Saint Germain had a baby. Now, there's no elderflower in Pomp and Whimsy. There's no rose. There's, you know, it's not the same ingredients, but it's this idea that it is a gin liqueur, right? So that's intentional. It's on purpose. It is this gin cordial concept that's been updated. It functions both as a gin and as a liqueur. It's probably one of the most versatile spirits you will ever try. And it's also, of course, incredibly delicious straight, as was originally intended with the cordials. So just to kind of give you a little bit of the sort of conceptual background as how we went how I went about creating the flavor profile for this, and then I can tell you about exactly what's in it and how to use it. Going back to this sort of market research idea, right, of just sort of recognizing that, hey, it seems that as women, we're kind of tired of being told what to like, right? So we're kind of tired of being told you like flavored vodka, or you like pink, or you like diet because you're a woman, right? And instead asking them this question of, well, what's missing? What's missing from what you're drinking at the moment? And describe that idea to me. This is how I started Pomp and Whimsy. So I went around the country and I interviewed hundreds of women and bartenders and had them describe to me their idea of an ideal spirit. And this picture started to emerge of, and I was specifically in the white spirit space, right? So I knew that I wanted to be in that white spirit area. Obviously I had a personal love of gin especially. But in the beginning, it was really just kind of asking women to describe this ideal spirit to them. And they started to describe to me a neutral spirit that had been lightly infused with botanicals, that they could sip straight. A frustration with flavored vodkas was they weren't good straight, that they could top lightly with bubbles, that was possibly a bit lower in ABV, because yes, it is important to stay in control and be responsible. And you know, they just kind of went on with this idea of this sort of botanically infused spirit. And every time I would stop them at this point and say, okay, you know what you're describing is basically gin, right? So, you know, take a neutral spirit base and infuse it with botanicals. That's what gin is. And they would say, but I don't like gin. Gin is
I was just about to bring that up. I feel like gin is so polarizing.
It's so polarizing. And people always have a reason, right? So it's like, you know, that's my uncle's drink. It tastes like Christmas trees. I've had a bad experience with it in college. I don't like tonic, etc. And I realized that, you know, in psychology terms, what was going on was a cognitive dissonance in this country, at least, very different in the UK. In this country, cognitive dissonance between what gin sounds like as an idea when you just describe it to people in its essence, and then what it tastes like. If you just describe the idea and then you tasted it, it would not be what you expected it to be. So I wanted to create what I thought people had in mind when I described the idea of gin to them. So that was the starting point. And then, of course, you know, kind of marrying that with this cordial idea. So what we have is a traditional gin that, you know, we make the gin from scratch. The gin base is itself fairly traditional dry profile. So it's going to have most of the traditional gin botanicals that you're used to, like, of course, juniper, but angelica, fennel, coriander, you know, lots of different citrus peels. We make that base first, and then we infuse that base with, that's the pomp, right? So that's the traditional part. And then we infuse it with the whimsy, with the loveliness, with the modernity. Those are exotic fruits like lychee and melon. There's raspberry in there. There's jasmine. There's lavender and a ton more citrus. And then it's very lightly sweetened with cane sugar, organic cane sugar, and it's bottled at 60 proof. So it's low sugar. It's lower ABV than, you know, most dry gins. And it's 100% natural and made from real food, because that was another thing that frustrated me about what I saw in the spirits industry, was that pink gin gets its pink color, not from strawberry, but from Red 40. And we as consumers are none the wiser. And this was something that bothered me as well.
I mean, sounds fantastic. Again, I've seen a few bottles around. I don't know that I've had it, or if I have, I've lost my tasting
note
for it.
We need to fix that.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you know, world's best spirits list and all that. and all that.
Loud, yes. It's not a vodka.
That's kind of the rule. Yeah,
it's a botanical spirit, so it fits into your.
That's right up my alley, right?
Yeah.
Sounds delightful, and I'll get a hold of some ASAP. But in the meantime, talk a little bit briefly about the Women's Cocktail Collective as we wrap up.
Yeah. So, you know, my whole personal mission, and, you know, what I'm trying to use Pomp and Whimsy as my vehicle for, is all about this idea of giving women back their rightful place, right? So I've talked about rightful place in the history of gin and the cocktail. But I also think we have a rightful place on the back bar, as well as, you know, taking women seriously as consumers and chief entertainers. So bringing diversity to the back bar is like a big passion point of mine. And I realized that, you know, as we went into to talk to bartenders about what they knew about who was making their spirits and what they knew about their customers and what the kinds of things that the customers are interested in, I recognize that there was a lot of interest and support for female spirit makers in the industry. But what I also recognized was that there wasn't a lot of knowledge as to know how to access that, right? It's not like it's on the bottle, right? Who distilled this? Or so there was this interest and a desire to make the back bar more diverse, but not really knowing how to do it. So basically, you know, I thought, well, how about we bring the mountain to Muhammad and make it really easy for you and create a collective that is of really amazing female founders and spirits makers who can come together and create a platform for delivering this diversity at the same time as creating a network to help other women get into the industry and bring even more innovation to it.
I mean, that's outstanding. I'm so happy to know that that exists. How do people get involved with this organization?
So you can go to our website, womenscocktailcollective.com, or to our Instagram, and you can find out a little bit about the current members. I think we're up to about 25 at the moment, and you know, more joining all the time. It's certainly not the universe of female spirits makers. But if you are a female spirits maker, or you want to become one, or an entrepreneur, reach out to us, reach out to me. I always take the call. And I have a lot of battle scars that I will happily show you, and hope that you don't make some of the same mistakes that I've made. And you know, if you're a female spirits maker and you don't want to be a part of the collective, but you just want to network, then I would love to meet you.
I mean, I think, you know, a good friend of our show, Jessica Lee Graves down in Texas, who makes absinthe and a couple of other things, I think she should be involved in this right away.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was looking at your website, I was like, the first thing that I thought was like, I need to let Jess know about this, which I guess because she listens to the show, we just did. So there we go.
Yeah.
So Jess, done.
Jess, get on that. Dr. Nice, so nice to have you on with us today. Do you have an Instagram for Pomp and Whimsy or for yourself that you'd like, or any other social media outlets you'd like to promote right now so that people can get in touch with you if they have any questions, or if they want to follow up, or if they just want to get a delicious bottle of Pomp and Whimsy? How do they find you?
Absolutely. Yes. Please do follow us on at Pomp and Whimsy on Instagram. You know, I'm so glad that you went to the website and you found the Kindred Spirit Society. This is a very new magazine for us, where we want to kind of bring all of these stories of women, as well as obviously give inspiration to the modern host and hostess. And that's really what our Instagram feed is all about as well. It's a little bit of education sprinkled in with some inspiration and some entertainment, and of course, beautiful cocktails.
Yeah, outstanding. And Damon, I already got my cocktail gram. Thanks so much. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool feature you've got there.
Yeah, send some cocktail grams, please.
Yeah.
So much fun. I was going to say, I just love doing this show because we get to have these conversations with the best people in the world. And this is one of my favorite episodes to date. I'm not just saying that. This has been a lot of fun.
Miss you too, man.
It's not because of you. Nicola, this has been so much fun talking with you about this. The website's so much fun. A lot of cool stuff on here. I love the cocktail grant, but then the Kindred Spirit Society is really cool too. So everyone check that out.
Yeah.
It's Pomp and Whimsy, andwhimsy.com for the website when you go check it out.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being on the show.
Such a delight. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I can't wait to try it. This is going to be, you know, I know you guys are about to go into the fall season, but, you know, out here in California, it's summer all the time. And like, this is like making me so thirsty just looking at the website, and I just want to be sitting outside drinking this like in a spritz or something, you know.
Absolutely. Well, one of the crazy things about it is that you can make all five of the most popular US cocktails more lovely with pomp and whimsy. So think margarita, think mule, think mimosa or spritz, think martini, think old fashioned.
Yeah, definitely. Ooh. Love a gin old fashioned.
Think about this very margarita. Cool.
Keep summer alive.
Yeah, margaritas on the brain. Damon, take us out.
Yeah, well, I want to thank you again, Nicola. This has been so much fun having you on the show. Everyone check out pompandwhimsy.com and on other platforms as well. And check out Heritage Radio Network. Click on the beating heart to donate to the station. And till next time we clink glasses, cheers, everyone.
Hey, cheers, everybody. Cheers. Thanks so much.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that Sam. It's gonna get you some in the end.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.